You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, November 9th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, a student walkout, or I should say a walkout by the University of Missouri football team in the shadow of a hunger strike. It's caused the University of Missouri president to step down amid problems for black students at the University of Missouri. Also on the program today, Democratic Forum will do a roundup with Digby. We also may mention some of the Republican candidates. Ben Carson. Wow. There's a lot of strangeness around him. We will discuss why Keystone is such a big deal. And a new report showing that 100... million more people will be living in poverty in 2030 as a function of climate change. Also, the war on Christmas, ladies and gentlemen, got here early this year, even before the shopping days are begun to be counted. All that and more on today's program. We will get to this story, too, about these new Democrats who are freaking out over what has been going on. And if you saw the Democratic Forum, you know what they're freaking out about. At least the talk is and it's just rhetoric, right? Because we're just watching people trying to run for president. But the rhetoric is definitely one that does not offer these folks a lot of hope. Again, it is just rhetoric. But folks, first, let me tell you something. I don't know if you're hiring right now, but if you are and you're not sure where to find the best candidates, I can tell you that as a business owner myself, I should really come up with a new title for myself. I mean, I just sort of refer to myself as like a do a podcast, but I really should be the CEO, and maybe I'll throw in a couple other chief creative officer. What
a podtrepreneur.
Oh, well, thank you, Matt. As a podtrepreneur, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. For instance, the guy who came up with the term podtrepreneur or whatever it was. I can also tell you that posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. Now, I was lucky. I have a podcast where I reach thousands upon thousands of people and fans. But it's difficult to do when you're short-staffed. There's no time to deal with dozens of different job sites until now, thanks to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter.com, you can post 100-plus job sites with one single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. And, folks, I got news for you. The best time to look for, to hire somebody is when you don't need to. The worst time is when someone like Matt says, old Matt says, hey, I got a new job. Like, I watched him get the new job and I was glad he got it. But then he gave me the 2 weeks notice right there. And I went into a full on panic. So the time to go and check out, to do your job search, to get the candidates, to just is to do it now when you don't need somebody. Getting the right people for your company is crucial. Try ZipRecruiter. Get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Try ZipRecruiter for free today. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Check it out, folks. Honestly, the best time to use one of these, to use this, is when you don't need it. And then you're set. All right, so let's get to this University of Missouri story quickly here before we get to Digby. So as of today, or I guess it was yesterday, I should say, he's a student at the University of Missouri. Jonathan Butler had been in his fifth day of a hunger strike, or I should say that was on Friday. So he had gone, I guess, closer to 7 or 8 days. He said he would not eat until the University of Missouri's system president, Timothy Wolf, resigned. Why? Because Butler and his supporters say that he was refusing to deal with a culture of racism on the University of Missouri Columbia campus. Now, this is something that has been growing. The anger has been growing for some time. I imagine the problems have been fairly consistent, if not maybe an ebb and flow, but for a long, long time. An organization called Concerned Student 1950, which refers to the year the university admitted its first black student. In other words, I think you had black students who were basically saying, hey, you know, it's been 70 years nearly. Maybe it's time that we don't have fear walking on the campus. Apparently, the university student body president says he was walking on the campus, guy named Peyton Head, when he heard the N-word screamed in at front of him from inside a pickup truck that was driving by. He put on his he posted on Facebook a quote saying, I just really want to know why my simple existence is such a threat to society. For those of you who wonder why I'm always talking about the importance of inclusion and respect, it's because I've experienced moments like this multiple times at this university, making me feel not included here. So on one hand, the guy gets elected student body president, but still has to put up with this crap. I mean, it's not to say that you need to be elected student body president to where you deserve not to be put up with this. But that dichotomy, right? Hey, we're not a racist campus. We have a cultural racism. We elected black guy, the head of the student body. Members of the university's Legion of Black Collegians say they were accosted on campus by a man shouting racial slurs. So that incident and others prompted condemnation from the campus's chancellor. But apparently, the head of the whole system, Wolf, just was completely non-engaging and non-responsive. And there were other issues that I think were also systemic. In August, the university suddenly announced it would discontinue its subsidies for graduate students' health care. Issues like this. And so this guy, Jonathan Butler, had been on a hunger strike. And then over the weekend, the University of Missouri's Legion of Black Collegians released a statement from the collective athletes of color on the Tigers football team. It's a Missouri Tigers, stating they're on strike from football-related activities until the school president steps down. And apparently, just like moments before we came on the show, he did. And it is, I think this is a really big deal. I mean, I have no sense of just of the import of football at the University of Missouri. I mean, they're a serious team, and there's millions upon millions of dollars at stake. But to see people put their education, their status in jeopardy for a larger cause like this, I think it's going to be really seminal. And, you know, we've seen this now where with the growing Black Lives Matter protest across the country and a willingness for particularly young African Americans to put themselves in some type of jeopardy. Whether it's the inevitable sort of sense of like, oh, people are really going to criticize me for screwing up this presidential forum, or I could lose my scholarship, or I could be deemed a troublemaker and the NFL may not want me, Ilo. But, I mean, this type of trouble. In other words, where I'm costing people money. And really impressive. I think it's really important. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about this stuff going forward. And it's very encouraging. And, you know, I've told you that I've been reading Eddie Gloud's book that's coming out in a couple of months. And very much about this and around this. Really fascinating. All right. Folks, just a reminder before we go to Digby. As you know, Lawyer Matthew tells me that he does Movember. This is the third Movember he's participated in. If you don't know what it is, Movember is a month where guys grow mustaches to raise awareness and money for men's health issues. I am a little bit on the fence about it, but I would imagine I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to occasionally not shave and whatnot. Nevertheless, whether or not you do Movember, you should check out Harry's. It's the official razor partner of Movember. So whether or not you plan to shave your mustache or not this month, you got to shave around it to get the mustache there. So you're going to need a razor. With Harry's, I've gotten the best shave I've had in a long time. As you know, I happen to love the shaving lotion as opposed to the gel, but the gel is great. I just don't want that stuff, that much of a mass on my face. I like it a little bit so I can get control over it. Although I will say this, my kids, it's true. They like the they like the foam. It's fun for them. I don't know, kids. All right, so
Saul's already shaving.
He goes around with my Harry's razor without the blades in it, and he knows he can't have the blades, yes, and pretends like he's shaving. I don't get it. Harry's, however, does deliver a superior shave for an incredible price. The starter deal is an amazing deal. I've said this before. With my code Majority Report, you get the razor handle, three blades, and either the shaving cream or the foam for $10. The guys at Harry's not only deliver amazing shave, they give 1% of their sales and 1% of their time back to the communities. Their website is streamlined, easy to use, takes less than 30 seconds to place an order. It is shipped directly to your home for free. Well, no shipping charges. You got to pay for the rate, but still, you're paying a fraction of the price. Set includes a razor handle, like I said, three blade cartridges, and the shaving cream or foam. Go to harrys.com right now. As a special offer for my fans, Harry's will give you $5 off your first order. If it's your first order with the code MajorityReport, that's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter code Majority Report. Even if it's not your first time, obviously, great deal. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program the proprietor of one of my favorite blogs. And it's been one of my favorite blogs for over a decade. Oh, my God. Ladies and gentlemen, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo. And it's only been, actually, I would say the last 2 years I've been able to say it.
That's true. It's kind of a hubbala, babbala, babbala, yeah.
Yeah, it took me a long time to be able to say that. But after a decade on the radio or so, I finally have nailed it. Digby, thank you so much for joining us. Friday night, I want to talk about the, it is such a, I want to talk about the Democratic Forum and sort of the race, sort of more broadly speaking. And then sort of transition over to talk about the Republicans. I don't know. I want to start this from 30,000 feet or from maybe the perspective of an alien coming down. Has there ever been, in your recollection, and we have seen, and by we, I mean you and I, have seen over the past decade or more, the Republicans get progressively more and more insane. It's not a generous thing to say, but I think that's from our perspective. Let's, you know, we can cop to that. That is the perspective. The divergence between where the Democrats are in terms of just being rational human beings and the Republicans is just becoming is so stark now. I don't know that it's ever been this stark.
It is stark. And, you know, this has been growing in intensity for a long time, as you point out. I mean, if you go back to the 90s, you know, you can see the beginnings there, starting with, I mean, this is the history of the conservative movement, right? I mean, it's not like they were ever particularly, you know, rational in many ways. I mean, there was always this anti-communism and this kind of crazy stuff going, you know, all the way back to the post, you know, right after the post-war period. But it has been growing in intensity since the mid-90s when the Republicans first took over the Congress. And this group, this sort of far-right group, started to gain prominence and power. And it's just, it has now reached a fever pitch. And I think people think that, well, they have to sober up here. You know, I mean, they're going to have to get practical. This is crazy. You can't have Donald Trump or Ben Carson, you know, as the front runners forever. They're going to, the voters are going to get themselves together. They're going to pick, you know, a somewhat normal candidate. Well, I mean, first of all, that assumes there is a somewhat normal candidate, and I'm not sure they're actually, you know, the party itself has pushed so far to the right that that's not acceptable anymore to be normal. And second of all, I'm not sure that's even true. I don't get the sense that this is, you know, just some explosion of ideological, you know, wishing. This is who they have become. And I mean, there's been a lot, you know, I'm sure you've talked about it many times, as have I, about the influence of the right-wing radio and the influence of the media and how, you know, the all of this is pushed. And then there's this this gusher of big money into the system. But whatever it is, this convergence of all these influences, it has brought us to a point where we now have a front runner, or one of the front runners for president, who is absolutely, you know, completely angry that anyone would suggest that he didn't try to stab someone when he was a teenager.
Right.
That's
right.
Where we're at.
There's two different things that are sort of going on here too with the Republicans, and I think it is there. The craziness has always been there, but this is sort of an argument I think that you and I both, among many others, were making in the aughts, which was that the balance of power, the sort of the critical mass, was shifting dramatically and rapidly, so that those who were sort of marginal before, you know, it's one thing where you had this sort of anomaly in the House, right, in the mid-90s, but that was sort of the beginning of the cascade of the balance of power shifting to the nut jobbies. And they, you know, you had a certain amount of nut jobs and then a certain amount of people who were pretending to be nut jobs. But what those people who pretended to be nut jobs did is they basically, I think in many respects without realizing it, recruited even more real nut jobs.
Yeah.
And now we're at the point, I mean, people have to just step back and think about this, because it's both hilarious and just sort of shocking when you think that the Donald Trump, who I think his 25%, let's say, maybe it's 22%, whatever it is, his fifth to a quarter of the Republican primary base, I think, is completely durable. And it seems to be wholly based upon not this guy's positions, because they're all over the place, not his ideology, but literally his personality type, which is, you know, best described in the vernacular as an a-hole. Right? I mean, honestly, like, what do people like about Donald Trump? He tells it how it is. He doesn't worry about being politically correct. In other words, he doesn't mind being offensive to people who are not white. He has a ton of money, and he's not embarrassed to flaunt it. And he has multiple trophy wives and on and on and on, whatever it is. It's just like a cartoon character, like Biff in Back to the Future. The other guy, like you say, is I think, you know, there's more and more evidence coming up that this is a guy who's sort of a little bit touched. I mean, let's talk about this for a moment. Like this story that he's now, that he wrote in his book about being in the psychology class. Have you heard about this and yeah. what it turns out to really be? Because this doesn't seem to be getting, I think we're going to hear more about this story as the week continues, but tell folks just briefly about this story that he wrote about being in a psychology class where it turned out he was the most honest person, at least in this class at Yale.
Right. Apparently what happened was is that he got word, and I'm unsure about how it was he was supposed to, people got this word. I guess it was from the article in the paper, in the student paper. I've been unclear on that. In any case, somehow or another, he found out that the final exams had been burned on a psychology class, which people aren't even really sure what the psychology class was, but evidently, it may or may not have existed. In any case, he says that he went and retook the class, and it turned out that in his telling that this was a test by a psychology professor to determine who were the honest students. And he was told by the psychology professor, and he says this very explicitly, that he was one of the few honest people in the class. And the psychology professor actually gave him $10 for coming and being honest enough to retake his test. Well, as it turns out, this was a prank, and there was no psychology teacher, doing this and saying that he was rewarding the honest students. Neither was, is there any evidence that Ben Carson could have been one of those honest students, because that particular part of the story didn't happen. Now, I guess it's possible that he went and retook the test because he's kind of a fool, but not because, there was any kind of a greater thing. It seems as though he has... he's turned this into yet another of his stories of his great, his spiritual, intellectual, and emotional superiority over everyone else. How different,
and
not to mention his physical bravery.
His direct line to God, too, right? Because wasn't it all predicated on the notion, like, he had been praying for to get $10, and he found a crumpled $10 bill on the ground, and then he got another $10 from the professor who said he was the most honest person in the class, and at one point... through this whole thing, this is now, I mean, he's retelling the story, I guess, 20 years, 30 years out in his book, and now we're 40 years out. And people have gone back and found where the Yale Daily Record talks about how we pulled this prank and announced that people are going to have to take over a psychology test because it got burned. And he either, it's unclear whether or not he went through the whole prank, and the whole prank was executed on him and him alone, out of this whole class, and he never found out about it, or he sort of like absorbed this event that took place and sort of placed himself in the middle of it, where he comes out sort of like, as the one honest man. But in either scenario, there's a tremendous amount of delusion it's hard to believe he could have gone through his entire life without realizing it was a prank. I mean, at one point he would have been like, hey, how come I'm not the only person who didn't get a grade on the psychology, or the only person with a grade, or when, like, it never came up again? It's strange. It's very, very strange. Now, I should say, this is the least of the parts about Ben Carson that offends me as a candidate, but it's indicative of... And this is what I've been talking about since, Trump zoomed to the top. This is not about Trump. It's not about Ben Carson. It's about the Republican Party.
Well, yes. And look at what's happened to Ben Carson since this flurry of, of a variety of revelations that have come out, where he's become a front runner. So the press is going back for the first time, apparently, in his life and attempting to validate the stuff that he's been saying. And he has, made his entire campaign, the basis of it is his life story. He wrote a Facebook post last week in which he sort of, I want to talk to you, all my people, about myself and what's going on here, in which he explicitly made that the case. He said, I don't have experience. I am not a politician. He said, you know, none of the founders had ever run for office, I mean, which is complete nonsense. But, you know, he says that they meant for people like me to be, you know, running the country, and this is my life. This is what I've done. I have, you know, I am this person. I mean, essentially just going over his life story as that being the qualification for president. Meanwhile, people are going back and checking some of these stories, and it's becoming pretty bizarre. And the fact that they cannot really, you know, they can't validate a lot of this story that supposedly much of it has to do with his religion, where he, like the stabbing incident, he says was when he went into the, after he tried to stab this person in high school or junior high, I don't remember. And he, you know, the stab was deflected by the kid's belt buckle. And he was so stunned by this that he went into the bathroom, he prayed to God, and this was the moment that he found God for real and realized he had to, quote, turn his life around. Well, you know, there's no evidence that this happened. It might have. I mean, you know, I suppose it's possible that that happened. But it's all part of this piece of him being, you know, him telling the story of how he's pretty much what you said, anointed by God. That this is the, you know, his trajectory in life has been bringing him to this point where he's going to lead the world, essentially, if he become president of the United States. And there are many people in the Republican Party who are, you know, more than ready and willing to hear this. I mean, he kind of draws from the Christian side, and I think that Trump draws from the white working class male
right.
side.
Right.
But nonetheless, I mean, these are very, very powerful factions within the Republican Party.
Well, I mean,
and
together,
apparently they'll believe anything.
And together
know?
They make up more than 50%.
Yes.
And that's what's amazing. Like, there's no crossover, or maybe a little bit, but there is not like huge crossover between the Carson and Trump voters. These are guys who are both at well over 20% and not drawing votes more or less from each other. And so we have seen, you know, it's stunning to me. And I wonder if we're going to see, you know, my hope was, and I don't know if this has been realized, is that Trump, at the very least, when he announced, my hope was at the time, like, this is going to force all of those mainstream reporters and pontificators to really acknowledge just who the Republican Party is, because, you know, they went through this process of something's unique about Trump. There's something fundamentally different about him. And at the end of the day, it is only that he is the perfect representation of the perfect Republican. And I guess Carson is too. I mean, one is the sort of the free market fundamentalist, which is the sort of notion where you are morally superior if you're not poor, and even more so if you're a billionaire. And the other is if you are essentially a theocrat who, you know, believes
right.
that really it's the apostles who were really the people who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution
right.
and have been here the whole time. I mean, and these are the guys who represent the sort of the hopes and wishes of what the Republican base is. And I mean, I just saw today where Ted Cruz has begun to attack Rubio as, and I actually think Ted Cruz is going to be the guy they end up nominating, as Rubio is one of the moderate faction of the moderate faction. And the Rubio people are immediately responding with, we are not.
How dare you?
How dare you say this? And it's just fascinating to watch. I mean, we've seen this trajectory, right, where McCain makes it through almost the entire campaign, but then has to appoint Sarah Palin. And
right.
where Romney never makes that pivot to the middle, right? I mean, the reason why he was nominated, Romney, was because he's moderate enough that he can win, and he could never be that guy. And now we're going the next step further, which is we're getting rid of the moderate, McCain and Romney, whether they were or not, I mean, just the perceived one, and going straight for the sort of the most Palin-esque person we could get.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're exactly right there. And to me, I mean, I've been writing for months and months that on paper, you know, I thought that Marco Rubio was the guy who would make the most sense for the Republicans to nominate because, you know, he's young, he's Hispanic, he can go up against the old, you know, lady or the old man on the Democratic side. There's an argument to be made there. But Marco Rubio has a problem, and I'm beginning to believe he can't overcome it, which is his participation in the Gang of Eight on immigration.
Yep.
I think the party has gone so far, and that was his rationale, was he could be conservative. He was originally voted in as a Tea Party type guy, but then he got into the Senate. He did this immigration thing showing that he could, you know, work with other people and that he was, you know, possibly going to be able to do some things that the party establishment knows has to be done if they're to survive. And he could make that pivot in the general once he got it. I don't think he can get it. The talk radio people are going absolutely ape on him now that he's starting to show some life. And I don't think he can do it. So therefore it's Cruz, and I think you're right about that. I think he's the one. And it's very interesting to me because the party, if you look at this 50% plus of the Trump and Carson voters, essentially they feel betrayed. They feel betrayed by the politicians, the people who have not, quote, fought for what they believe in, have not gone to Washington and accomplished what they promised. Now, these are people who clearly don't understand how the government is structured and how it works. They didn't understand that when you have a Democratic president, no matter what, you're not going to be able to get exactly what you want. That's just not going to happen. And especially when an enemy like Barack Obama, you know, a Kenyan usurper, you know, foreign Muslim agent that they all believe he is. So the fact that they assumed that they could get what they wanted by voting for a guy like David Bratt, say, you know, or one of these congressmen, that this was their, you know, that they have, this is the mandate. I voted for this guy. He's going to go to Washington. He's going to get what we want. And if he doesn't, he's betrayed us. That seems to be their beef, that they were betrayed by the Republican Party. So they're looking to these outsiders who, both of them, Trump and Carson, their argument is, I don't know anything about how this government works, and I don't care, because when I get in, I'm going to get it done. And that's it. I will get it done because I'm me. Carson, from, you know, he's anointed by God, and Trump is anointed by Trump, and they both have this peculiar talent to get out, to go beyond the rules that are hindering the Republican Party from getting what they deserve. Now, you know, this is a recipe for disaster for them because, you know, clearly, no matter what, those two guys are very unlikely to win the presidency. But Cruz, on the other hand, has a very interesting argument along those lines, which is, I have been in there fighting this fight. I'm the one who stopped the closed down the government. I'm the one who stood up and fought for you, and they hate me for it.
Right.
Everybody in Washington hates my guts, just like they hate your guts. And, you know, I will go in there, and yet I, unlike Trump and Carson or whomever, I know how to work these levers because I'm actually, you know, I've got a little bit more savvy about how this stuff works. I don't know if that will work for him, but I can certainly see him making it, and he's positioning himself to inherit those voters, the Trump and Carson voters, should they fall out. And, you know, I think we all assume that at some point, I don't think Trump, funny, I don't think he has the stamina.
Well, my theory about Trump has been all along is that he's not interested in becoming president. He's interested in appointing the president. And he has had the best relationship with Cruz. Cruz has been incredibly disciplined in making sure that he never steps on Trump's toes. And I think that, you know, I think what happens at one point, Trump says, a member of my family has a disease that could be fatal. I'm not sure. I'm not going to say because I respect my family. But I need to be able to give 175% as president, and I can only give 104%. And so I'm going to drop out and become chairman of Ted Cruz's campaign committee, essentially. But, yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating, you know, because, you know, I get these emails still like, we are so close to impeaching the president, you know, and your dollars, you know, like they have been the Republican base. And it's really sort of like I think people, it's helpful to think of this as like the conservative movement with this sort of like cellophane overlay of the Republican Party, which has structured some of this stuff as well. Like, you know, this rules and stuff about and excuses about getting stuff done. This is all sort of harkens back to some version of G.W. Bush, right? Which is like, I don't need to be an egghead. I just need to be a guy guy who can sit down, have a beer, work this out. I'm the CEO, yeah. president. I get it done. That type of mentality. And it's just, now it's like that message sells to 60% of the Republican Party
right.
opposed to 35% of the Republican Party, or at least the ones who are in charge of the nominations. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. And so with that backdrop, let's shift over to the Democratic race, because it's I think there's been more and more talk about how striking it is to watch the Democrats debate or have a forum versus the Republicans. Like, the Democratic race has been in some ways a lot more substantive and particularly more granular. You know, some of the questions that Rachel was asking last night or Friday night, I should say, were far more granular. In some respects, I'm starting to feel a little bit like there's not quite as much happening as there's space to happen. But I want to get your take on what the Democratic race has been shaping up to be, and particularly, you know, any thoughts that may have come out of Friday night.
Well, I thought, first of all, the forum, you know, that format was, I thought, you know, really interesting for people who are interested in politics. You know, I don't know whether or not that has quite the zazz that the Republican debates or even the other debate format, you know, that the Democrats had with Anderson Cooper. But for me anyway, and I think people who are really interested in actually, you know, watching these people up close for a while be interviewed and being able to compare them one right after the other that way, which I think is really useful. You know, how often do you get that where you can see the three candidates like we did, one right after the other, answering similar questions, how they behave? You know, this is interesting stuff. I just don't know whether or not it extends beyond, you know, the political junkies who care about that. But regardless, they were all three very interesting. I thought O'Malley, that's the first time I've ever seen him sort of be the person that a lot of people thought he was, which is a talented politician. He seemed loose. He seemed smart and in control of the conversation. And I thought he did very well. And the other two, of course, you know, they're sort of positioning themselves in their place in the race in a way that's very interesting to, you know, liberal types like me. who are seeing this sort of Democratic Party. I don't think I've ever seen it before,
right.
Where, you know, the argument is centering around, you know, a progressive agenda on a level that is, you know, I'm still a little astonished by it. But, you know, there's room for it because the Republican Party is off, you know, holding their circus on the other side of town, and it's almost non-political. It doesn't have any substance as far as a real agenda, on a granular level. I mean, who knows what these people are thinking?
Well, the granular level on the Republican Party is exactly how many feet high and wide is the wall.
Right, and what color the beautiful door will be.
Yes.
I mean, that's exactly right. So, you know, that's it. So we're having two very, very different processes here, and it's almost a little dizzying for people like me because I'm covering both of them as you are. I mean, don't you find yourself kind of going, wow, I'm in two different countries here? Sometimes I feel like I'm in two different dimensions. You know, they are operating on very, very different premises, these two primary campaigns. So on the Democratic side, for me, this is a really, really great primary, and I hate primaries.
Right.
You know, they're family fights, and I don't have a stomach for that stuff. I really don't. And, you know, when it gets ugly, you know, we always end up sort of kissing and making up afterwards, but there are scars and it hurts, you know. So for me, these are tough times on this sort of thing. But this time I'm finding it to be very I'm very optimistic because I feel like, you know, the candidates are great, and I feel like they all three of them really. O'Malley actually impressed me the other night. I mean, he would be, you know, I don't know. Everybody wanted Joe Biden, you know.
Right.
If Bernie and Hillary dropped dead, you know, so why not O'Malley? I mean, he's as good as Biden. So whatever, you know, it's fine. And I enjoyed that, you know, that way of exploring. I think it's an excellent way to measure
where the Democratic Party is right now. And I noticed, and you brought this up with me via email, this this new Dem panic that's beginning, that, you know, the campaign is moving too far to the left and they really have to be careful and, you know, you can't expand Social Security and on and on. I mean, this is actually delayed. I'm surprised that it's taken them this long to kind of gather their strengths. The Fix the Debt people, they're also marshaling themselves for this. You're going to see the centrist wing of the Democratic Party. It's very powerful, too. It's not just some, you know, tiny little faction.
Right.
These are very, very powerful people brought to you by Wall Street who are going to start exerting some pressure, and probably particularly on Clinton, but it's going to happen across the board, and we'll see, you know, the panic set in, and then we'll see how the reporting starts to reflect that. And that's always very interesting because I think most of the reporting comes from the centrist faction as well. So you end up seeing, you know, we'll end up saying, oh my God, the hippies are out of control again. But for the moment, in this golden moment here, it feels as though the progressive faction has a voice, and it's a big voice, and it's one that's that people are actually hearing. And so, you know, I come away from this rather pleased. I think the work of the last decade in pushing the Democratic Party to the left, away from the, you know, well, they were at the right, you know, and
right.
Now suddenly, I mean, we actually have... We have candidates talking about gun control. I mean, nothing could seem more obvious for the left, you know, the Democratic Party to take up than that. Fighting for Planned Parenthood. I mean, these are things that really, you know, they weren't before, and now suddenly they are again. I mean, of course they should be. And here we are. I think that is largely a result of the left kind of working, you know, plugging away year after year and finally bringing the party back around. And, you know, the other side has just gone completely over the cliff. So, you know, my impression on Friday was, you know, this is good. I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I wish all the debates could be like that. Of course, on the Republican side, it would take 4.5 months because there's so many of them that, you know, we'd all be dying of starvation if we had to sit there and, you know, go through a format like that.
Yeah, no, it was a great format. And I think, you know, and we should say that, you know, this is obviously, it's rhetoric. You know, one of the things in that new Dem piece is like, I think at the end where, I don't know if it was Will Marshall, who was formerly of the DLC, but it was Ron Kind from Wisconsin. He said, I'd lie if I said I wasn't disappointed with the statement that she made on TPP. Everyone knew where she was on that and where she will be. But given the necessities of the moment and a tough Democratic primary, she felt she needed to go there initially. Now, look, this is what we experienced with Obama, too, right? I'm going to renegotiate NAFTA. And almost as he's saying those words, he sent Austin Goolsbee. Goolsbee was one of his economic advisors to Canada, saying, like, he's not going to really negotiate NAFTA. When he says that, what he means is he's not going to. And so with that said, and you don't, you know, you know, with the idea that to a large extent, to the extent that there's been movement, it's been rhetorical, which is not nothing. I mean, obviously, and, you know, the Democrats are not necessarily in a position to execute some of this stuff. But I guess, and I say this as someone who is, I think, fairly open about being a pretty big fan of Bernie Sanders, that I'd like to see it go further, frankly. I mean, you know, it seems to me there's space. I mean, just to take a moment to do a little critiquing of what we saw, that Sanders is either running a campaign to win or to pull the conversation to the left. And I feel like he has achieved the latter in many respects, right? I mean, much of what's going on in this in these forums and the conversations, and like we've seen this with Clinton on Keystone and TPP and to a certain extent with debt free college and some other things, that she has, I would imagine, you know, and we can't know, that 6 to 8 months ago to a year ago, the positions she's taking now are at least sounding more to the left than she anticipated she would have had to have done, right? I mean, I imagine so. Maybe that's not the case, but to the extent where it's hard to listen to what she's saying and Bernie Sanders, and I think unless you're extremely discerning, to see a lot of daylight there. I mean, is that right from your perspective? Like, you know, the difference between free college and debt-free college, you know, you need to dig into that to really see the difference both from a practical standpoint, but then also from an ideological standpoint. And I don't think that distinction is being made clear enough, at least from my perspective. What's your take on that?
I think you're right, and I think the people have sort of staked out their loyalty for other reasons, which often happens on the Democratic side. You know, there's the candidates are close enough that really that whatever distinctions are there end up becoming sort of, you know, more symbolic than substantive. But this is interesting because, you know, Bernie Sanders, nobody's going to mistake him for a centrist. I mean, he just isn't, and he never has been. So the fact that he and Clinton are, you know, they're even swimming in the same pond, you know, in the same policy pond in this way is just, it's kind of an astonishing turnaround. And I don't think you can give Bernie all the credit there. He's the guy who's that voice in the campaign. But you know, you've had Warren out
right.
there.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
right.
there've been people for decades who've been pulling this. Now, to me, the distinction between the two of them is kind of it does exist, and you really do have to look for it. But you know, if there's a complaint that I think that people have about Bernie Sanders, it's that his entire worldview is class-based. I mean, he's a democratic socialist. So that all problems are sort of seen within that prism of class and you know, basically economic justice. Whereas Clinton comes from, and that's not to say that Bernie doesn't care about social justice or, you know, civil rights or anything. Of course he does. But I'm just saying that is his worldview. That's how he comes at the world. And if there's a criticism of him, it's that he too often sort of defaults to an economic policy agenda to answer the call for these other things, social justice and racial equality and what have you. Clinton, on the other hand, kind of has a clever way of transcending that, and the way she's doing it so far is she's addressing a lot of it toward women. She takes that economic argument and puts it into the sort of silo where it affects women, from family leave to, you know, even on Social Security, where she's to the right of Bernie, who's openly for expanding it. She sort of put it into the silo of these very older women who need to have their Social Security expanded when they're, you know, they hit 80 or something and they're just living in total poverty, and we have to fix that. So she's found this way of sort of combining, or what I think of as transcending, the social justice side in particular toward women, and I think to some lesser extent on a racial level, with that class-based argument and trying to pull these strands of the party together in that way. I think she's a little bit more successful at doing that than Bernie is, although he's starting to kind of find his way through that. I don't think it's a natural for him. And I don't even know whether it's natural for her. This is a strategy or tactic. I don't even, you know, give a damn, to be honest.
Right,
I don't
right.
care. You know, I mean, I don't need politicians. I don't even pretend to see into their heart. You know, that's not really important to me. But I have noticed that this is sort of a different approach that the two of them are taking. And I think hers, one of the reasons probably why she's appealing to, at this point, a broader range of people, is that her rhetoric, the way that she sort of fashioned it around the social justice for women, with the economic policies, I think that's kind of speaking in on a certain level to a bigger group, a bigger collection of factions within the Democratic Party. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's true, but that's just how I've been seeing it. And I think it's kind of an interesting thing because as for a progressive, I mean, this is all good, right?
Right, right,
I mean,
right.
Can, you know.
But, you know, and because I think what she's able to do when she does that is she's able to both sort of like include herself on some level, or not even include herself, but to have a project a more intimate understanding, a more intimate experiential understanding on some level. And that, you know, there are times where I feel like what Bernie Sanders is expressing is not as inclusive experientially. But that is, I mean, see that, but that dynamic is what I guess I'm starting to get a little mounting frustration with the Sanders campaign. And I want to see them go further because I don't think that they're ultimately swimming in the same pool. You know, since we have this open playing field, and since it's true that Bernie Sanders is not the reason, is just like sort of almost the manifestation of the reason why she's moving in that direction. He's got to say, like, you know, when you say only for old women, that's where the difference is that I'm not talking about just helping those that we can point to and say, these are the most vulnerable. I'm talking about helping everyone where we are fundamentally, because he'll say we need a revolution, but he's not really articulating what his vision is and how it's different from Clinton's. He's making the I'm more sincere about this argument, I've been here longer argument. I'm not just talking the talk argument. But at the end of the day, he's not saying, here's the difference. When she says she wants to help the most vulnerable or the poorest, I want to help those people. But I also want to change how people who are not the worst off, who are not in fundamental crisis, but are in a slow rolling sort of like abyss or, you know, nagging chronic pain as opposed to acute, potentially lethal pain. I want to alleviate that as well. And that's where the fundamental difference is. That's the difference between a society that says, we're going to provide everybody a free college education and one where we're going to give you ways in which to pay off a debt. Or we're going to make sure that everybody under Social Security lives a life that is fundamentally better than the life that they're living now on Social Security, not just those who are doing the worst on it. And that I feel like he's not articulating. And I'm not, and maybe it's just that he doesn't have the experience, frankly, of campaigning in this wide of an arena.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I hadn't really thought of it that way, but you're right. I mean, there is a space there, obviously, as she has moved to the left, for him to open that up and you know, make the full-blown kind of revolutionary argument that, you know, that maybe people are ready to hear. I mean, it feels like
if you're
going to
say the words
right?
revolution, if you're going to say the word revolution, you might as well tell them what you're talking about, because it's not going to be any more damaging than the word revolution in terms
exactly.
of your prospects.
And he's already, yeah, and in America, if you're up there saying, yes, I'm a democratic socialist and look at Denmark, it's a great country, I mean, you're already there. So you
right.
might as well,
tell
you know,
what's
you
going
might
on
as
in
well
Denmark.
Do it.
Take us all to Denmark, because I think we would actually look around and go, whoa, wait a second. You know, I mean, we had once, I don't, was the guy Swedish, I think, or in our studio, and we were talking about, you know, are there working, you know, we were talking about the working poor in Sweden, and we were like, what do people who are working poor there, you know, do? And he just looks at us and he's like, we don't have a word for that. We don't have, like, we don't have that concept of working poor. If you're working, you're not poor. And that, you know, frankly, that's pretty enticing. The idea that we can't even conceive of that here. That's so strange. So, I mean, I, you know, that to me seems to be he's leaving stuff on the table that I'm not quite clear why. And I would imagine it's, you know, it's sort of like a notion of, you know, and if he's going for the win and somehow feels like I can't go that far, because I imagine, you know, it's there in his policies. He's just not teasing it out. If he's going to go for the win, it seems to me that he needs to, you know, really get more aggressive about providing a sense of what his policies are going to mean for the African-American community. And he touches on that. But I'm just saying, from sheer politics, that's where he doesn't have the name recognition. He needs to catch fire in that community.
Yeah.
In a way that is extremely difficult for a guy with his resources, including lack of 25-year history of being introduced to these communities.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's one idea I'll throw out there that Bernie Sanders should take up. If he wants to, he's already compared the U.S. to Scandinavia, and I cannot remember which Scandinavian countries have this and which don't, but I know that at least one has, which is a requirement for gender parity in representation. You have to have an equal number of men and women in political representation. That's just the law. And they're not the only country, but they do have some countries that are like that. I think that's a revolutionary idea. I think it would be a total, I mean, it would shock the hell out of people, just the mere idea that our great meritocracy would require quotas, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can imagine the argument. But it would be a good one, and it would be one of those that isn't economic. It's not an economic argument. That's one that it goes directly to, you know, certain socialistic ideas of social justice that I think would be really, really exciting if he were to take that up, and it would kind of throw a shot across the bow of Clinton's.
Right. Feminist. How do you answer that if you're Hillary Clinton? I mean, it's going to be very uncomfortable for you to say at that point, like, no, I don't think that should exist. Right. I mean, that's the idea.
Exactly.
Is that, you know, either way, it seems to me that for Bernie Sanders, for what he's trying to build, whether it's to win or to build a movement, it is incumbent upon him, since he has put down that marker, right? He's the only democratic socialist that anyone in this country that more than 10% of the country could name, right? I mean, he's it. He is supposedly, in the context of our politics, the outer definition of left. And it seems to me that if you're going to put down that flag, either consciously or unconsciously, you got to really be left. and that may mean, you know, pushing it even further, because I think that's what it's going to take also for him to gain more traction. Because I think, you know, people found him, I certainly did, more charming than he's ever been in that Democratic forum, right? I mean, the guy, I get the sense now that he's a funny guy to be around.
Oh, I love the guy. I mean, honestly, his everything about him, his personality, his record, his, you know, I mean, I've always been a big fan of Bernie Sanders. You know, I mean, if you're a liberal in this country, a real, you know, progressive or liberal socialist, whatever, I mean, this has been your guy for a long time. I mean, he is a terrific guy, and he's got a lot of appeal. You know, I don't know how far that goes. I mean, he's a New Yorker. He's got, you know, he does have the whole, you know, Larry David thing, and I don't know if that hurts him or helps him. I don't know one way or the other. But, you know, to me, he's very, very, he's a very charming, accessible, obviously decent human being that I'm thrilled that he's saying and doing what he does. I mean, I can't get enough of him, really. I mean, I just hear what he says, and I'm always kind of, yeah. But you're right. He does have room to go further. I wonder, and I don't know if this, you know, I'm just talking out of the top of my head, but, you know, he does have a very traditional campaign manager in Tad Devine. You know, that guy, he's a professional. He's a hired gun. And I don't know how far he thinks it's safe for Bernie to go. You know, I think he is probably pushing him to be much more negative in the campaign. I personally think that's a mistake for Sanders. I think that goes against his brand in a way that is, you know, I used the word brand, didn't I? Ugh.
Well, but I
think it goes against his image in a way that I think would be detrimental.
The idea is, right, is to create some definition for yourself and for your opponent. And there's two ways to do that. And the first way has been ineffective at this point, because Clinton has been so effective in talking and sounding very similar to Bernie Sanders, at least in those areas where there's a distinction. And then she has her own sort of like, quiver full of arrows. If you aren't willing to go even further and take her essentially into the deep end of the pool where, you know, we really start talking about things that are left. Then the only thing you can do is you have to push her further into the shallow end. Right. And so I think it's a mistake and it's a missed opportunity. And I wonder if it isn't a reflection of the limitations of his campaign management, because, you know, these ideas, you're going to say I'm a socialist, you know, you're out there already. That, you know,
yeah.
Let people know what that actually means, because that's going to sell better than the term socialist.
Yes, absolutely. Because then at least you put some meat on the bones of what socialism means. And in fact, I mean, we don't know. I mean, look at the weird crap that the right wing is selling. I mean, is there any reason to believe that anything Bernie Sanders says is going to be any more out there than what they're selling? I mean, this is, you know, we've got the front runner for the Republican Party out there saying he's going to save the world by being a better negotiator with China. I mean, and Japan and how they're killing us, and he's going to make Mexico pay for a wall. I mean, that is nutty stuff, and that's not even the nuttiest of the stuff that we're hearing. So, you know, I don't think that there's a lot of risk in this campaign for Democrats. I mean, despite with the new Dems, you know, the timorous new Dems, just, oh my goodness, you know, the left is getting out of hand again. No, sorry. I mean, look at the other guys. That's not a problem. I mean, I don't think, it's hard for me to imagine how the left could say anything that would be equal to the lunacy that's coming out of the right, and therefore they are positioned to be the proverbial grown-ups in the room. No matter what, I think even Bernie Sanders, you know, coming out for, you know, a guaranteed wage, you know, whatever. There are a million things he could be saying. And I don't think it would sound crazy compared to what is happening on the other side. So, you know, there's kind of a unique opportunity here, isn't there, to push the envelope beyond what we normally would think was acceptable, even under those terms, even under the terms that maybe, you know, Tad Devine is saying, you know, hey, Bernie, don't go too far, because, you know, if you want to win, you're going to have to, you know, pivot to the middle or do whatever they always say. But, you know, where's the middle right now?
Well, yeah. You know? And yeah, I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that the first thing he's got to do is get through the primary before he starts worrying about pivoting to the middle.
Well,
and,
exactly.
And you've got Marco Rubio.
That would be a unique challenge.
You've got Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Ben Carson, I think, already saying no exception on abortion for rape or incest. I mean,
yeah.
You know, that alone to me seems like they've wrapped themselves in a cape of lead, and they're not going anywhere. I mean, seriously, like I don't know what would be the functional equivalent on the left for that. I really don't.
Gun confiscation. If there was a Democrat out there who said, when I become president, I'm going to confiscate every gun in America, that would be the equivalent as far as I'm concerned.
And of course, everyone needs to wear denim jumpsuits, like those worker clothes. Like
everybody's... right, right.
Digby, as always, a real pleasure to talk to you. I imagine we'll have the opportunity to have this conversation again. Particularly following, we've got the Republican debate coming up tomorrow night.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition it really is weird. I mean, I feel like on one hand, I'm doing something that is like very sort of literal and wonky-ish one day. And the next day I'm like,
I know.
Critiquing cartoon, like drawing.
It's disorienting.
It's weird.
It's disorienting. And I keep writing about this sort of, you know, meanwhile, you know, I write about the Democrats and their, you know, sort of arcane arguments on, you know, this stuff like student debt. And then meanwhile, in bizarro world,
right,
you know, we have this freak show going on that is just, I mean, that's what I'm saying. This is like two different two different dimensions that our politics are happening on, which is really fascinating. I mean, you know, I hope that that somehow we're able to sort that out over this, because this says something very interesting about our country. I just don't know what it is yet, but it's
so strange.
Sure.
It's like as if PBS decided one day, like, we're going to program a block of programming where we have like a 2-hour Bill Moyers, documentary, and then we're going to just follow it up with SpongeBob.
Exactly. And we assume that the same people are going to be, that somehow or another that everybody has to watch both and make a decision as to which one. Which one gets the, is going to run things, SpongeBob or Bill Moyers?
I've never been more sort of open to the idea of like, let's just split up the country. Let's just do it and get it over
with. Well, I think we're split. We're just split in a very weird way. I guess the question that we're all going to have to ask ourselves is, what's the road back to a country? We've never been really together. There's always been
right.
these splits. But this is so dramatic, so different than anything I've ever seen. The two parties are on completely different tracks. And I'm not what has to happen? And I'm not sure that what everybody thinks will happen, which is that the Republicans will recognize that they've gone too far.
And they'll decide
to moderate, and then they'll nominate John Huntsman, and everybody will be happy. I don't see that. They're so far gone. I don't know how that happens. So I'm not helping out here, but
I haven't even heard a viable explanation of how you get there. It is, they're going to overreach. They're going to nominate Ted Cruz. He's going to lose badly. And then everything's going to go into a hidden black box, and they're going to come out the other side, and they're going to be reasonable. Like, I don't understand that process, because the difference here is that, when Goldwater, when Goldwater happened and they had this sort of reevaluation, or I guess for the Democrats, it was, McGovern or Dukakis. And then all of a sudden you get Bill Clinton ultimately, they were just talking on a presidential level, and they had this sort of latitude because the parties were sort of like not shut off from any direction. But now it just seems to me to be like, the reason why when Ted Cruz loses, it's not going to be just that he was too centrist, because that's not what it's going to be. It's going to be because he was sabotaged by the establishment wing of the Republican Party, and they're going to go even further and become more vicious. That's what's going to happen.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. Conservatism can never fail. It can only be failed. And the Republican Party is their enemy at the moment, and will continue to be as long as if conservatives lose. That's just how they see it, and I don't see any way around that. I mean, and also let's look at what the Republicans did in the 1960s. They nominated, after Goldwater, they nominated Richard Nixon.
Right.
I mean, it's not like they, and I get, yes, oh, Nixon was considered a more of a moderate, but I think we know better. And they knew better, too. The only reason Nixon
would
go to China is because he wouldn't be red-baited by Richard Nixon. And so I don't honestly think that theory plays out in the Republican Party. It did in the Democratic Party. There's no doubt about it. After McGovern, they all went and licked their wounds and, started nominating the most milquetoast people they could find, and basically, tried to work their way back to the middle, and they allowed the right to define them. That doesn't happen on the Republican side. And I think it's much worse today than it used to be. I agree with you. But I do think that their instinct is to double down. It's not to, retreat and withdraw. Look what happened after 2012. They had that postmortem.
The autopsy,
they did
right.
their autopsy. And it was pretty clear what they had to do. Did they listen? No. I mean, they don't.
Well, I know what happened at that autopsy. They had set up one of those devices that runs electricity from a bolt on the top of the building. And when the lightning struck the bolt, it reanimated the corpse. And the corpse got up and started walking through the village.
That's exactly what happened. And that monster ain't going anywhere. No. I mean, that monster is out of control, and he is, he's heading for the village, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
I think,
and I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know how you deal with that.
I think the solution.
Them,
I think the solution is after Ted Cruz loses, I think it's what we're going to see is either one of two things. We're going to see Eric Erickson start a new party and they'll call it the Erickson Party. And there'll be only, you know, the Republican Party and the Erickson Party will be two small minor parties in the country. You have basically, you know, global warming gets to the point where we all come together because we've lost, a significant portion of land mass here. And we've really got to invade Canada so that we have a place to live, essentially.
Well, there's a happy thought.
Right.
There's a good one. That's a nice way of dealing with this. Let's hope we'll all come together under, you know, in our dystopian hellscape.
Exactly. Digby, a great place to end it. Hopefully next time we talk, we won't be there yet. So,
Yes. Well, thanks for having me, Sam. I enjoyed it as always.
Pleasure. Thanks, Digby.
Okay.
Bye. All right, folks. God, look at this. Did we really just talk for that long?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. You know, I saw the other day on, I was looking in on iTunes, and we're supposed to be doing 40 minutes, right? 45 minutes in the first half.
That's correct.
And I haven't seen a 45-minute show in weeks.
No, got to rein it in, dude.
And that's what I was like. I was like, I'm starting on Monday.
It, but I knew with Digby that there was no way it would happen. So just sit back and let it go. Mm. But in general, we got to rein it in.
Well, you're all in trouble. This is basically what happens with Myla and the use of her phone.
Right. That's where she
gets it from. I keep threatening and threatening.
Her phone is Digby.
I'm like, you better put that away or something's going to happen. What's that?
Digby was a great guest.
Yes.
So,
no,
I mean,
Digby is a great guest.
She's been avoided. I stand by how long.
I'm not mad at myself about Digby. I just, it's just, I'm...
Digby's great.
All right. Look, folks, you better become a member or you wait till you see. You're going to see 42 minutes and that's it. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that allows us to do the show on a daily basis. And as a way of saying thank you to our members, we offer supposedly 50 extra minutes. That ends up being like closer to an hour or two these days. Everybody's getting rolled back. Also, you can support this program by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can buy the Majority Report blend. Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow night is the Republican debate. Michael will be doing a Matt and Michael Monday without the Monday or the Matt tomorrow. We got to come up with a new branding for that. All right.
Michael Monday.
And then we will be
squared.
On in the 15 minutes before the debate. We're going to be running the debate live. As you know, last time we did this involving a Fox station, we were shut down. So at the very least, they cannot touch our audio stream, ladies and gentlemen. No one can touch that. So, we will be doing it on our program. If you are telling people and they want to see the debate for whatever reason, tell them to go to majority.fm. That's where we're going to embed it. We're going to try and not use the words YouTube or video or something like that. And I believe quite sincerely that because of our critiquing of this event, that we are within the bounds of fair use, and that is the case. So,
Carson on Tuesdays. That could be the name of it.
Oh,
just
boy.
Me in Ben Carson mode. No, don't worry, that won't be the case. Matt, are your parents going to be the only people that are going to be listening and watching our live stream and flipping back and forth between us and Fox News, but like sincerely?
No, I think they'll be watching like HGTV or something. Like
okay,
that.
So do
we get a lot of people. We get a lot of people who stumble onto the stream and are just like,
that's
"What?
The best
these newscasters?
Morons.
They are clearly liberal
idiots,
and they're just stupid.
Trying to listen to a serious debate about whether dinosaurs exist or not, and these morons are interrupting it.
I can't hear whether or not these candidates talk to God." All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can join us in the fun half. All right, folks. See you soon.